kitchen. There's a turkey running out the door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Delicious. Good evening and let me start over. Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour here on KRCB. Michelle Anna Jordan, I'll be with you for the next hour, as will two guests I am so glad to have here. But first, just a couple of things. Did you have a nice time either indulging in Winter Wineland weekend or avoiding the traffic it always causes? I remember the first time I went, I think it was the very first year, quite a long time ago, and it was raining, and it was a drought season. I think it was right in the middle of the second long drought I've lived through in Sonoma County. I had on this spiffy new raincoat, and my hair was really long, and I went with a friend, and we went to several wineries. And if I remember correctly, that's the last time I got to wear that raincoat. It did not rain again until that coat was completely out of fashion. So we seem to have every indication that it is the third year of a drought. So I have two recommendations. Don't buy a raincoat, because if you do, you're guaranteeing no rain until it's out of fashion. And second, I want everyone, conserving on water, of course, I want everyone to wash their car really well. Just make it shine, get all the mud and rocks and everything out from inside, and that should guarantee that it rains. So that's Miss Michelle's advice for how to deal with the drought in the next few weeks. Tonight's show came about in just the most wonderfully serendipitous way. The show that I had been working on, and that Kainoa, our producer, had been working on for really several weeks, just at the last minute didn't come together, and I still don't really know why, but it didn't. And then I got an email from Mouthful's former engineer and producer and my hula sister, Nancy Lawrence, telling me that there's this new Hawaiian deli out in Bodega Bay. It's like, oh, that sounds good. And then I got another email saying that she'd gone to the Sandpiper, that highly visible landmark restaurant in Bodega Bay, and that she had a fabulous restaurant but had some sad news, and included a link to Save the Sandpiper. And it seems there's some trouble in Dodge out there in Bodega Bay, and a restaurant that's been there for a really long time is having some difficulties. So I made a couple phone calls, which led me to our first guest this evening, Jay Weissman, one of the principals of the Sandpiper. Welcome to Mouthful.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And my name's, Steve Weissman.
Steve, what did I say?
Jay Weissman.
You know, I get going, and that's why I write things down, and then I look at them, and I still get them wrong. I know you're Steve Weissman.
Yeah.
And I saw in your bio there on the website that you worked for, you also do some work with Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. And I said, oh my gosh, I've been trying to connect with Tumbleweed for years. And the next thing I know, I'm on the phone with Jay Schaefer. So Jay, welcome. It's just a thrill to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you found us.
I've been looking at your tiny houses ever since I heard you, I guess it's about 3 years ago, on, I think, Fresh Air. And it's like, wow, Sebastopol? Terry Gross just said Sebastopol? It's right here. What a cool thing. So normally I give websites at the end of Mouthful because I like y'all to have time to get a pencil and a piece of paper. And I know I never have one when I'm listening to the radio and always hope they'll repeat things at the end of the show. But tonight, if you're near your computer, I really suggest that you check out tumbleweedtinyhouses.com. And peruse it as we're talking with Jay. You can also, if you aren't familiar with the Sandpiper, you can go to savethesandpiper.com, and there's a click through that takes you also to the main website. So, on that note, and that much of a mouthful, where do we start? Tumbleweedhouses.com. I'm getting everything wrong. You know what I do? I Google Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. It goes to the website, and now, you know, Safari is so smart.
That's the way to do it.
You type in T-U-M, and the next thing you know, you're on the website. So, yeah. Tumbleweed Houses. So, welcome both of you, and let's start with the Sandpiper.
All right.
I think that's readily accessible to everyone in Sonoma County and to visitors. It's right there on Highway 12. White with blue trim still, isn't it?
No, we actually painted it probably about three or four years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Yellow with white trim.
You know, and every time I drive by it, which is fairly often, I see it white with blue trim.
Almost all the buildings right around us have that color, so it's not a far guess. And the place is just a very popular old-style restaurant in Sonoma County where we're in Bodega Bay, and there's a lot of tourists coming through Bodega Bay, but we really are the locals' restaurant. And almost all of our business is Sonoma County residents. So it's a place I love to be. I love working there. About 2 years ago, the property on which we were on sold, and that's 15 acres in Bodega Bay, so it's a pretty nice piece of property. It's right on the water.
Now, is anything else, any other businesses?
Oh, certainly. There's the bait shop that's right next door to us. And then there's also the RV park, which is called Puerto Bodega RV Park, which is on the same piece of property as well.
And when it sold, did things just go on undisturbed because you have a 7-year lease?
Well, actually, when it sold, the first month, everything was pretty normal. And a month into the new ownership, they started talking to us about evicting us. And we actually have a lease through 2015. So it was pretty disturbing. The person who bought it is a real estate developer from Southern California. I'm not sure what he wants to do with the place, but we're fighting to protect our lease right now.
And what about the bait shop and the RV park?
Well, the RV park they own. So.
The developer owns
the RV park.
Okay.
And the bait shop, I haven't had a chance to talk to him since this has been going on. He's really hardly ever there. They're open, I think, 1 hour a day in the morning from 5 until 6 a.m.
Oh, I guess you don't buy bait at, like, 1 in the afternoon, do you?
Well, he has a fishing business. So
okay.
The people who go on his boat go into his shop, and it's really a supply shop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So for people who don't know, and that would include me, when property sells and there's a pre-existing lease, you can't just, like, act like that lease didn't exist, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
But unfortunately, that's what's happening. In my opinion, that's what's been happening to us. And so in the past 2 years, we've been getting eviction notice after eviction notice after eviction notice. And it's been very tiring. It's exhausting. It's stressful. And it's not right. And so we made the decision, myself and the other managers of the restaurant, to bring this to the public and make it a public issue besides just a legal issue.
Now, normally, someone serves an eviction notice. It's like, you know, you have 3 days or you have 30 days to get out, and then they come and they have the sheriff take all your stuff out and they lock the doors.
Right.
If he's served you several eviction notices, something's wrong with each one, I would presume. So what's that part of the story?
So the first 3 times that they served the eviction notices, they did not take us to court. They backed off. They just
just let them drop.
I think so. I mean, I don't know what their thinking was, and I don't know what their motivation was. This fourth one that we received, we actually are going to court on.
And when did you receive it? When do you go to court?
We received it on October 15th, and I got served in December 20th or so. So we actually had our first court date. My lawyer filed what's called a demur, and I'm not even sure what that is. But apparently that went well for us. I was there in the courthouse.
I think a demur might be, hey, that you can't do this.
This is not...
something that can be done for these reasons.
Exactly.
And then you have to cite case law.
Yeah, yes, and that's what he did, and that was granted.
Oh, that was granted?
Yes.
Cool.
So the next step's on, you know, on them. I don't know what's going to happen from here on out.
Now, has this this process has been going on for 2 years?
2 years.
Has it taken away, has it taken away from y'all's ability to operate the business effectively?
No, it really hasn't. Uh-huh. It's just been one more really added pressure. It's been something where the uncertainty has been difficult.
Yeah.
And the stress on myself and my business partner, my wife, it's been very hard for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the
sure.
Two of the eviction notices came right before my honeymoon.
Oh.
And that was really sad. It was definitely on my mind when we were gone, and that was a hard experience.
Uh-huh. Now, have you had a conversation with this with the what? Can we say the owner's name?
Yes, we can. Sure.
Okay.
So Richard Battaglia is. We've actually requested to speak with him. He's not so far has been unwilling to speak with us.
Does he live in Bodega Bay?
No, he lives, I believe, in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually offered to fly down there and meet with him at our own expense, just to talk with him. So far, no interest from him.
Oh, so he's an absentee landlord. That
correct.
I guess just has those dollar signs. What was the deal? And you may not know this, and if you don't, it's just fine. But sometime in the last several weeks, a list was compiled and published about the most expensive.
Oh, yes.
And I forget, was that most expensive seaside communities or most expensive communities?
I think it was small town communities.
Okay.
And yes, Bodega Bay, I think, was 32 or 34. And it was having to do with the average house price.
And that has to do with that development out in where you don't drive through it when you go to town.
You mean the golf course development?
Yes. Is that why?
Well, everything in Bodega Bay is expensive.
Okay.
So, yes, I'm sure that's a large portion of the
reason
why.
I just thought that was.
There's really not
what
a lot
about.
Of smaller, affordable homes in Bodega Bay.
That's true. I've been looking for years. I love Bodega. Bodega Bay is one of my very favorite places in the world.
Yeah, mine too.
I like your weather. You know, I really, really like the weather. I'm sorry that's happening. What is your next? So the next actual course of action. Legally, the ball's in his court. You have to wait to see if he's going to volley it back.
Exactly.
In the meantime, what are you doing with Save the Sandpiper?
So Save the Sandpiper is this campaign that really I'm the person who's doing almost all the work on it. And for the past 2 or 3 weeks, it's been my full-time job.
Really?
Yes, indeed. It took me a long time to really... This lawsuit's been going on for so long, or this process... I started off with 500 pages from lawyers going back and forth, and I had to try to sum that down to something that was reasonable and understandable. So I put the campaign together, and I've ordered signs. I made the website myself. Let's see what else. I've made this little button. So I've talked with the staff and explained to them what's going on, and of course they're scared too. You know, they're
sure.
scared because we have a staff of 25 people, and they don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a lot of reassurance as well, just to tell people, we'll get through this. We're in the right.
Mm-hmm.
This will pass. What else have I done? Let's see. I'm put the petition together, and I've been talking to as many people as I can about this.
Mm-hmm. I imagine, you know, you've got all your huge customer base probably all signing the petition.
Yes.
Is it also increasing business? Because people think, oh, this Empire Pier, no, I got to go see him.
Hopefully it will, but so far we just started making it public on Friday.
Wow, so I was one of the first ones there. Awesome.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, the first few weeks I was working on the campaign itself, getting all the materials together. And we do have a large customer base. We have about 5,000 households in Sema County who are on our mailing list, and they'll all be getting a letter about that asking them for their help with signing the petition as well.
Interesting. Well, we're going to take a little musical interlude, an appropriate one, I might say, and then we're going to talk about your other life so that we can also bring Jay into this conversation. We'll be right back here on Mouthful. the theme from the movie The Sandpiper here on Mouthful. We are talking with Steve Weissman of the Sandpiper Restaurant. Restaurant or cafe? It's restaurant.
It's a restaurant, yeah, yes.
In Bodega Bay. And you work in some capacity that we are going to find out with Jay Schaefer of Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. And Jay, I just have to say, your tumbleweed houses are just so delicious. Just looking at them, they're just like little housing bonbons. I want to gobble them up.
I'm so glad you like them.
They're, you know, you can look and think, oh, God, you could do a whole little community. You could have, you know.
Yeah, I
can make them
that.
Get big really fast. You know, I could have one for this and one for this. Tell me a little bit about the history of tumbleweed.
Well, tumbleweed really started as a very personal thing back in, it started back in 98 when I started living in a tiny Airstream trailer, which didn't quite hold up to Iowa winters, which is where I was.
Oh.
So I had to build something else that was equally tiny because I decided I just didn't want to deal with too much space in my life. There's all the cleaning and the mortgage payments and whatnot that go along with space. So I decided I was going to build my own tiny house from scratch. And while I was at it, since it was so small, I might as well put it on wheels. So I built a Carpenter Gothic style house on a 14-foot travel or a flatbed trailer. And I've been living in spaces of 100 square feet or less ever since.
Ever since?
Yeah.
And immediately prior to the Airstream, what had you been living in?
You know, it's funny. I don't think I've ever been asked that, and I've never talked about it because I'd lived in the summers in the back of my pickup truck on Long Island because I had a job out there. And I rarely mention that because I don't want people to think it's just some homeless guy deciding he has to move into
a bigger place.
A bigger place. You know, it was really a choice because I didn't want to have to deal with all the space. But it was definitely a move up from the back of the truck.
Uh-huh. But that was during the summers, you said.
Yeah, and then in the winters I would live in a fairly standard sized efficiency apartment, which I guess is very small by American standards, but still much bigger than what I've been living in ever since.
Mm-hmm. But so you did have a. You didn't move from like a 7,000 square foot.
No, right away. I graduated slowly. Uh-huh. I did live in 4,000 square feet as a little kid.
That first one you built on wheels, where is it now?
That is somewhere on the East Coast, I believe. I sold it to a guy in New Hampshire, and I don't think he still has it, but I've heard rumor that it may be in Vermont now.
Okay. And how did you end up in Sonoma County?
Well, there are so many different reasons, but really the universe just told me I had to move to Sebastopol. All signs pointed to Sebastopol. I was getting allergic to Iowa, literally the pollens there. And I just always loved the weather out here in the North Bay. And two friends who didn't know each other both said, "You should check out this town, Sebastopol. I think it's for you." So I figured that might be a sign, too. So.
And when you got out to Sebastopol, were your intuitions right?
Yeah, it was perfect for me. Uh-huh. I mean, I moved out of Iowa. I'd been living in Iowa for 20 years plus. And as soon as I got to California, I felt more at home than ever.
And where were you born?
I was born in Storm Lake, Iowa, but I did live in the suburbs of L.A. for 14 years of my life as a kid.
And so you came here. You didn't bring the little tiny house, that first one, with you, did you?
I did not. What I did was I sold that house to the guy in New Hampshire because when I heard about Bay Area real estate prices, I figured I'd better build something small enough that I could parallel park it if I had to live on the street for a while. So I built an even smaller house, downsized from 100 to about 70 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought that out with a woman who I was living with at the time. We both lived in it for a while out here. But I quickly realized that I didn't really need to live on the street because I had great luck with finding spaces to live.
Mm-hmm. I should tell you before we go any further that there is tiny house history in Sebastopol. I don't know if anyone ever mentioned Anna Cherney to you?
No.
Well, let me tell you the story because I find it very interesting that you ended up here and are doing that. Quite a long time ago, Anna Cherney was a young woman in New York City. She had been born in Odessa, Russia, She had to quit school and go to work to help support the family when she was in eighth grade. And I don't know her maiden name, but she and Charlie were sweethearts when they were teenagers. And Charlie had a flatbed Ford somehow. I don't know exactly how he came up with that, but he had a flatbed Ford, and he built a little house on it. And they were in love. They did not get married. They began living together in this little house, and they called it the Little House on Wheels. And they started they left New York City and started driving west. And they stopped in various places, and I've seen pictures of them in Philadelphia. And they got one of the very first advertising contracts from, I believe, Columbia Pictures. And they tacked up a poster on the side of the house and were paid $250 to drive all around advertising the movie. But they also had postcards printed, and whenever they would stop to spend the night, Anna would give tours for 10 cents. People could come in and see the tiny house, and they would get a postcard.
I had no idea.
And they made it all the way through. I mean, they went all the way through the United States, and they were young progressives, you know, left wing all the way. And Anna went on to become very much a supporter of progressive and left wing causes, gave lots of money to, say, KPFA, for example. She was an artist in her own right. She made a beautiful bust of Paul Robeson, very involved in all sorts of progressive and democratic causes. But eventually they got to San Francisco and then came up to Sebastopol and became very successful chicken farmers.
Huh.
And on, not Barnett Valley Road, but Burnside Road. Burnside Road, there's a couple who, Anna died, oh gosh, it must be the mid-90s when Anna died in her 90s. And a young couple who do beautiful pottery live in the house that they built there. So that is the Sebastopol connection to Little Houses on Wheels.
Yeah, another thing I have to Google.
Yeah, I don't know, and I never have. I don't. Anna was a good friend of mine. I don't know if anything has gotten onto the internet about it or not. I've never looked.
Well, I actually I failed to mention one last reason why I moved out here was that I did have the sense that this would be the mecca for tiny houses. Mm-hmm. There is a tiny house thing going on out here. Of course, it's kind of like a green belt out here. A lot mm-hmm. of attention paid to sustainable building in general, and I'd met a few people mm-hmm. who are into that sort of thing from this area. So when I moved out here, within 2 weeks, right after moving onto the property that I first inhabited, I discovered that my next door neighbor up on the mountain had about 5 tiny houses that he'd built in the woods. So. They're all over the place. They're not very visible necessarily, but uh-huh. they're all over the place in Sonoma County.
And Steve, how are you involved in Tumbleweed?
I deal with the business side and website side of Tumbleweed. Uh-huh. So Jay does the designs for all of the houses, and mm-hmm. he's really the person who created Tumbleweed, and I've been mm-hmm. working with him to help promote Tumbleweed.
Okay. And the design, we should say the 86 foot, which I've seen, is it 86 foot, 89 feet? 89 foot one. It's everything you would need to live. Bathroom, shower, storage, kitchen, that sort of thing. Are these, and then it goes up, I think the biggest one, does it go up to like 300 and something?
They go even bigger than that.
Okay.
They go up to all the little ones, you know, the ones we have on wheels are under mm-hmm. 200 square feet. Mm-hmm. But then they jump up from there to mm-hmm. meet minimum size standards.
Okay.
So they jump up to about 250 and then all the way up to about almost 1,000 with additions.
And yeah. You've designed all of them?
I have.
And what is it that you're... This is a really general question, and I know there's no simple answer, but I started thinking, because I often am thinking about you when I'm walking around my house, and I just look, could I downsize that? Could I downsize that? Could I downsize that? And I see some things that I could, and then some things that's like, I don't know how he pulls that off. So let's talk first, since this is mouthful, let's talk about kitchens.
Yeah, well, my kitchen is very small. It's like the size of a fairly large closet. It's about 4 feet by 4 feet. And it's got an L-shaped counter with a very small sink, a very small refrigerator underneath the counter, and a toaster oven down there as well, and an RV cooktop, just a double burner. Mm-hmm. I've never cooked much at home myself.
Okay.
It's more than enough for my needs.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I definitely wouldn't want to cook a large Thanksgiving uh-huh. meal.
Something, okay, where's the pantry? Where do you have all your spices? Where do you have your 30 different kinds of salt and 10 different peppers, you know?
Well, Steve gave me a spice rack for my birthday.
Okay.
And I chastised him because I told him never to give me anything again that I'd have to put into my house because the spice rack ate up every last inch that was left over.
One thing I did think of that is makes your houses seem very, very timely. I was looking at this, my hallway, which is crammed full of lots and lots of CDs. I thought, well, the MP3 player. You know, every single CD in my house could go in an MP3 player and, you know, probably fill up a third of it. So that solves the music problem, I guess.
Yeah, technology is paralleling the tiny house thing.
Yeah.
It seems like small houses are becoming a bit more well-known. And at the same time, technology is just shrinking things down. I do have a friend, Greg Johnson, in Iowa City. You know, that's where I used to live. And he has had all of his books and all of his music scanned or recorded digitally.
Really?
And it's all in his laptop now. So
he lives in a tumbleweed tiny house as well.
He does. He lives in a house that makes my house look palatial.
Really?
Yeah, his house is only 6.5 feet by 8 feet. And then it's got a tiny loft on top of that. So he lives very small. You know, he's very Buddhist about everything.
And, mm-hmm. and I guess in a way it's, you can sort of think, well, a lot of apartments in New York are really small. And then so you end up having a social life that takes place outside, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Outside the walls of your dwelling.
Yeah. Speaking of Greg, he calls that outsourcing. you know, he does almost everything outside of his house except for sleeping and working at his desk.
Uh-huh.
So he goes to the gym to take most of his showers, and he eats out a lot, much as I do.
Uh-huh. I'm going to guess that these are people who, for the most part, don't work at home.
Well, actually, that's not the case,
okay.
surprisingly
okay.
enough.
It's more the opposite.
Yeah,
really?
For some reason.
Yeah.
Like, I work at home all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it's a matter of just making sure there's enough elbow room in the area that where you're going to spend the most time. So
mm-hmm.
my desk, for example, is pretty huge for a tiny house.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend almost all of my waking hours sitting at my
desk. At your desk.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a pet?
I kind of do, and that brings me to a pretty convoluted situation. I got married 6 months ago, and she came with a cat. So now she moved into a structure just 20 feet, maybe 40 feet away from my house, and the cat's in there, and she's in there, and she's living there temporarily until we have a chance to build her house on wheels, about 2 or 3 times the size of mine.
So you guys will live right next to each other.
Yeah, next door neighbors.
God, that sounds ideal.
Yeah, we're thinking about marketing these as marital aids soon.
Yeah, I think it sounds absolutely perfect. You're listening to Mouthful.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one. And they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes. They came out all the same. And there's doctors, there's lawyers, and business executives. And you're all made out of ticky-tacky and you all look just the same.
It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. I hope you are enjoying the show. We're talking about two diverse topics that intersect through one of our guests, Steve Weissman of Sandpiper. We also have with us Jay Schaefer of Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. A very green idea and very charming. They're really cute.
Thank you.
They're just adorable. And you can see, I mean, when you think of what, I mean, this whole thing with this housing crisis and the ridiculous, you know, starter castles that people were building in the 90s, and I guess to some degree still are. it just seems like I look at those things and I think, wow, it's the end of civilization. And then I look at your little houses and I think, oh gosh, maybe it's all going to be okay.
I'm glad you see it that way too, because I go through some suburbs and I have to imagine 20 people living in each house in order to appreciate the potential beauty there. Actually, for a long time, I would pull my punches about McMansions or, you know, large houses mm-hmm. with a lot of wasted space. And I should say that when I say a large house, I really just mean any house with wasted space. And I say even a, you know, 7,000 square foot house is a small house if it's being used well.
Mm-hmm. But what is wasted space? How do you look at something and know if something's wasted?
Well, if it's unusable or being unused. Okay. Uh-huh. And a lot of houses these days are just really status symbols, or at least large portions of them are.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's a lot of misguided exhibitionism going on that's costing us a lot of resources in terms of fossil fuels and other building materials. Mm-hmm. And then also just the emissions that go along with it, you know, just 18, I guess, not to go into too many statistics, but the average American house puts out about 18 tons worth of greenhouse gases per year. So thinking about
and
that.
Through various.
Oh, heating mostly, heating, I suppose, okay. Cooling. I mean, the average American lawnmower, just a two-cycle lawnmower, puts out more greenhouse gases in, I think, an hour. I'm not sure about the actual numbers here, but something like an hour compared to a car going all the way, going 2,000 miles.
Really?
That's what I read.
And, wow.
So in that, you haven't even gotten in the front door yet with the lawnmower, so it does add up.
Uh-huh.
You know, and as I said, I like to pull my punches a lot when it came to larger houses, because I know that not everybody, of course, is going to live in 100 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
But recently with the bailouts and all, I'm starting to, it's starting to bother me a bit more now that we're all paying for the houses and, you know, that the banks really forced more space on us than we needed for a while, because we're... In order to get a loan, we have to get a house that has so many bedrooms, so many bathrooms, and whatnot.
Oh, really?
Well, usually if you're going to get a loan, there's a formula that makes a house, you know, worth funding.
Having not done that.
Yeah. And seeing how that's been pushed on us for a while, and then, you know, it's wound up being the way it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just in the South and drove along the Gulf Coast and also drove into New Orleans a couple of times. And there's the unlivable Katrina trailers that are just basically in these huge lots. They're going to be used for scrap. And then there's the new Katrina trailers, which are infinitely better. They're actually kind of cute. They look like new shotgun. You know, they just look like shotgun apartments, and they're not gross, and they don't look like they're, I mean... They don't look like trailers. But then I think, you know, gosh, you look at something like these tiny houses, and I could see them being used in as solutions for all sorts of housing difficulties, either through something like hurricanes or all manner of problems. Has that been something you've either thought about or been approached about?
Yeah, actually...
Well,
Steve's smiling. The business manager's smiling.
Well, yes, indeed, people have asked us many times, and it's definitely something we've thought about as well. I think one of the challenges for that to happen is for the banks to recognize these as something that they're willing to take a chance on.
Now, you had something on the website about applying for a grant, didn't you? Wasn't there something on the tumbleweed houses about...
I think you're right. It's one suggestion of a way to go and get a loan. So far, the banking industry has looked at these houses, and they don't really know what they are. They don't understand them, and they're looking at them and saying, well, they don't fit into our model. Mm-hmm. We're not willing to take a chance on them. That's what we've heard about it so far. So right now, we're having a really hard time to find a bank that's going to finance these houses.
So far, they're not financed. You can't finance them.
There's been one bank that said they would do it to their customers, but they were in Illinois. So as mm-hmm. long as you live in Illinois, you can get a loan.
Uh-huh. And so that brings me to another question I've had for a while. How widespread are these houses? How many have you done? I mean, can you say in numbers?
Yeah, I can easily say, because we haven't done very many houses.
Oh, okay.
We've only built 12 houses in total, but we've sold at least 200 sets of plans by now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's there's so it seems there's three ways. You can buy the plans and build it yourself. You can buy an everything done, but you have to assemble it.
No, there's only actually two options.
Oh, okay.
You buy the plans and build it yourself.
Okay.
Or you buy one that's ready made.
Oh, okay.
And when you buy the plans to build it yourself, we go around previously the country and now the world teaching workshops because we're selling plans all over the world now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great for me. I get to go on vacation.
Where are some of the places you've sold them?
We recently sold our first set of plans to Italy. So somebody's building a house in Italy. We recently sold a set of plans to somebody in England as well.
Taiwan was about a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland. Mm-hmm. Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then all of the materials and what you have a working list of all the things you have to buy. So you go to your local lumberyard and hardware store and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like, well, apparently, a lot of the people who are interested in this are do-it-yourselfers.
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm.
And it costs you a lot less money if you do it yourself.
Yes.
You know, one thing that was really neat about doing it yourself is that you can, if you're really active in it, you can help have people help you build it and also use a lot of recycled materials. There's one woman who built a tumbleweed house, and she was able to go and find a lot of free materials. She built her whole house for $10,000.
Wow. What size?
It's the same size as Jay's.
Okay.
So it's 90 square feet.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think you're talking about D, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, she did that with a bunch of friends, and they she ripped apart sock monkeys and made little beards so on the barn raising day they could pretend they were Amish.
Okay.
That would be D.
That made me forget my next question. Oh, it seems like something that might work for Habitat for Humanity, too.
Yeah, I think it would if they can get it. The problem, again, being that it's not in the box, and I think that they
right.
have certain, you know,
yeah.
they want to do everything in the box
mm-hmm.
for funding and whatnot.
So talk a little bit about who finds you and who else, who's buying the house, the houses.
It seems like our market's divided almost evenly into three markets. Those who want these things as freestanding additions to their existing home, maybe a little studio in the backyard or an extra bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those who buy them as a vacation cottage to put on some land somewhere far away. And then there are those like myself and Dee who actually live in them full time. And it's pretty much an even split.
Okay.
I love it when they buy them for the to live in full-time.
To live in full-time. On that note, it's time for another musical break here on Mouthful.
The shadow of your smile when you are gone will color all my dreams and light the dawn. Look into my eyes, my love, and see all the lovely things you are to me. Was far too high.
Another version of the theme from the movie The Sandpiper, which I guess that means the sandpiper wants a little more attention.
Sounds good.
So we've been moving back and forth between the two topics of the sandpiper and the tumbleweed tiny houses. And I was actually going to move to, I wanted to go back to the sandpiper for a bit anyway, though. Both topics are really interesting. I just love this about the tumbleweed tiny houses. I hope that you at home are able to check this out online, either as we're talking or later on. It's just so cool. I want to see more of them. Little streets with lots of them on it.
That's my dream.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good one. And then you could take one of the bigger ones. It's sort of just an extension of the co-housing idea. But you take one of the bigger ones and you make a little community restaurant.
Yeah, you must be looking at my site plans that I have tucked away. I've got like 100 plans for such communities.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I think it's just, I think it's so completely intuitive. It makes that sort of intuitive. You know the book, Malcolm Gladwell's Blink?
I
thin sliced Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. The second I heard Terry Gross introduce you and start to talk about it, I knew. And it's just that concept. It comes, you grasp it, I think, instantly, intuitively. And then the more you talk, and then when you look at the houses, look at pictures of the houses, it's like, yes, it's just such an intuitively right concept.
Yeah, I think that people have a natural inclination towards things that are necessary, you know, just mm-hmm. boiled down to their essence. And mm-hmm. people love tiny houses because they're just the essence of house and nothing more.
Mm-hmm. And the one stumbling block for me, and I don't mean stumbling block to it, but the one little sort of mental hurdle I have to always clear is, okay, so how do you spend a lot of time around a table enjoying meals with people? It's like, well, then you have a bigger one where there's a whole bunch of people who live in little ones. You have a bigger one, and there you go.
Exactly.
So.
Or you can rent out the Holiday Inn with all the money you're saving on a mortgage.
Yeah, but then you have to go there.
Right.
I sort of like the idea of that familiar dining room that you control yourself and that is yours and that is really homey. That's a really important thing to me, and it's sort of how I think of Mouthful. In my mind, when we're here on Mouthful, we're always in that intimate little dining room and talking around a table. So that's an important part of life to me. As is eating. Let's talk about your menu. You all have right. a little problem with the website, at least as how it was showing up when I was using Safari.
Oh, that could be. I don't have a Mac, so I don't know.
Yeah, and I didn't have time or inclination to switch over to Firefox. It wouldn't scroll, mm-hmm. and I got to the category biscuits. I was like, well, what kind of biscuits and what do they come with? Tell me. So tell me about the biscuits.
Well, we have biscuits and gravy.
Okay.
And it's a homemade gravy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually not the chef, so I can't tell you everything that's in there.
Okay, that's okay. But it's biscuits and gravy.
It's biscuits and gravy.
Having just been in New Orleans, one of the breakfast dishes is you can have biscuits with all kinds of things. And I had biscuits and debris. And debris is all the stuff in the bottom of the pan after they from roast beef. Mm-hmm. So they get all the pan scrapies and stuff and put that on the... put that on these really nice light biscuits. You also have a lot of seafood that you serve at breakfast. Would you talk about that?
Certainly. Well, we do the crab and shrimp omelet, and then we also have anything with crab and shrimp. Any kind of breakfast you can do with crab and shrimp, we try and do that.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from that, I don't believe we have any other seafood on the breakfast menu.
Oh,
so we just
and
keep
we're getting Lawrence, who's a whiz on a PC, is getting it up here for us. You serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Every day of the week.
We're every open, day of the week.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We close 2 days a year, Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you have a liquor license.
Beer and wine. So
beer
no
and
liquor.
Wine. Yes. So if you want a glass of champagne with your, you know, crab omelet, you can have it.
Absolutely. And it'd most likely be a mimosa.
A mimosa.
Or two.
And I think community one of the ways that you really know you're in a community restaurant is by the waves of people who come through at different times.
Mm-hmm.
I know, God, Lawrence, what is the name of the coffee shop, the crazy, insane coffee shop at the corner of Bodega and Bloomfield?
Hardcore.
Yes. I was doing a story on local coffee shops, and I went there a few times, and I standing there at a table drinking espresso. Somebody looks at me and says, well, you're not at 8 o'clock. You know, when are you usually here? And it's like everyone knew each other based on the time that they came. So is it like that at the Sandpiper?
There's definitely certain regulars, and there's people who are Friday nighters, or there's people who are the breakfast crowd only, mm-hmm. and we do have that.
And so do you have, like, do you open it early enough for fishermen to come in?
No, there's not too many fishermen anymore in Bodega Bay. We used to open at 6 a.m. Now we open at 8 a.m.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, but the whole fishing community of Bodega Bay has really changed a lot. I started working at the Sandpiper 13 years ago,
uh-huh.
and when I first started working there, we would buy the fish straight from the docks or the fishermen. And I remember the fishermen would come into the restaurant with a fish slung over their shoulder and walk straight into the kitchen.
And they're not doing that anymore?
No, the fishing industry has really changed a lot.
Yeah, we had Tony Anello on just very recently.
Yes, yeah, from the Tides.
No, Tony is from Spud Point.
Okay. And yeah, there was a place that was right by us that was on the docks right outside the restaurant, and they went out of business about a year ago.
Mm. Okay, here we go. We got the menu. It's lunch and dinner, though. So where are you sourcing your seafood now?
It comes from all over. Yeah. And I think this is one of the greatest changes in the fishing industry, is that fish comes from everywhere in the world. It's from China, Thailand, Canada. We try to get as much local as we possibly can, and it is seasonal. So when it's not seasonal, you're usually buying it from any other place you possibly can.
And do you deal with a local vendor?
We deal with four seafood vendors, yeah.
What's your favorite thing on the menu?
My personal favorite is the crab stew.
Talk about the crab stew.
So it's a cioppino based stew.
Oh, fisherman's crab stew. So right. It's a red based.
Red based. It's a half a crab. It's a gigantic meal, and it makes a great mess, which I love.
Mm-hmm. Wasabi tuna salad.
So the wasabi tuna salad's it's the fresh tuna, and it's going to be seared rare, so it has that nice red color to it.
I'm perusing the menu here. It doesn't scroll all the way down, though.
No, it looks like it got cut off. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. I'm not getting to the golden seafood platter.
As an impartial observer, I can tell you that everything is great on the menu.
What's your favorite thing?
I like the BLT. It's tuna BLT.
Yeah,
correct.
The tuna BLT. I was reading about that, being a major fan of BLTs.
Yeah.
I would tell you our most popular dishes are clam chowder. That's really what we're known for.
Tell me about your clam chowder, because Bodega Bay, I mean, you've got, Spud Point clam chowder. You've got the clam chowder contest.
Bodega Bay certainly is a great place for clam chowder. There's no doubt about that.
And, tell us about yours.
Well, let's see. I don't know what I can say about ours. It hasn't changed in 20-something years. Mm-hmm. So the recipe has been the same for
cream-based.
It's a New England style, which means it's a white clam chowder. It's got... It's a pretty standard. Mm-hmm. It's a basic recipe, so it doesn't vary or stray much from it. And it's more mild, so it's not as fishy flavor. Uh-huh. I'll tell you something funny. When I started working at the Sandpiper, I never ate seafood, and I ate the clam chowder. I just loved it, and I started exploring more and more seafood. Now I love seafood. I eat it all the time. Of course, I eat it at work all the time, but it was what turned me on to seafood.
Where were you raised?
I was raised here.
Oh, you were? That's right. You were raised
in Sebastopol.
Right. There's a lot of people raised in what should be a major seafood area. I've always found this one of the odd things about the Pacific Coast, especially the North Coast. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the coastal mountains or what, but there's this sort of disconnect where you can go for years and not eat any seafood here.
It's absolutely true.
Okay, I want to talk about some more of the, but I can't see the whole menu. What do you think are your most popular things? I know out at Spud Point, they cannot make enough crab cakes. If you don't get that out there early in the day, they're sold out.
There's really not a whole lot that we sell out of. We plan pretty well for that. Uh-huh. But
you got a much bigger space.
Yeah, we do.
They're a tiny little place.
But our most popular dishes, besides the clam chowder, fish and chips is our second most popular dish. People just love the fish and chips there. And we go through tons of it, literally tons of it every year. And let's see what else is really popular. When crab's in season, people love crab.
Of course.
So right now, crab's in season, and we have some real nice crabs. And it depends on what's fresh. So, when halibut season's available, when halibut's available and in season and fresh, that's very popular. And also that's available right now. Mm-hmm. But it just depends on the season.
And do you think the most popular way for people to enjoy the seasonal crab? Are you finding they want it cold, they want it hot, they want it in a crab louis, they want it cracked, they want it in something?
They want it the whole crab with the shell. They want to break it themselves and get into it.
That is such good news. Yeah. You just have no idea. There were a few restaurants. I don't want to say which ones because I love them and I don't want people to say, I'm sorry, that didn't work for them. They could not give away cracked crab. They couldn't get anyone to order it. So I'm really happy to hear that people are still willing to get dirty with crab, because it is one of the most delightful things in the world.
And the experience of breaking it yourself just adds to the meal.
Absolutely. Chilled or hot?
Usually, people don't actually ask which way they can get it. So.
Oh, they don't?
No.
That's always my second question. Do you have it? Can I have it chilled?
So, no, we actually don't serve it chilled. We serve
you
it
don't?
Hot. No. But
so I have to bring my own little cooler full of ice and just plunge it in there.
I'm
for
sure
10
we
minutes.
Could do it for you if you asked.
And on that note, we're nearly out of time, so I want to summarize. The reason that we have had these two topics joined together here on Mouthful this evening is because our guest, Steve Weissman, is one of the principals of Sandpiper Restaurant and also works on the business end of Tumbleweed Tiny Houses, hence the connection. And thank you so much. I know you've had that cold that's going around, and you haven't coughed once.
I'm actually feeling pretty good right now.
Let's tell people, save the Sandpiper. Can they download petitions and have people
Absolutely.
Sign
them? Absolutely, yeah. SaveTheSandpiper.com. We have a petition page, so if people don't mind signing our petition to help save the Sandpiper. We have a lease for 7 more years, and our landlord is trying to evict us, and we are fighting.
And exact directions for somebody who, for some reason...
Okay, so the Sandpiper, which is one of the charms about the Sandpiper is that it's hard to find. And people complain to me about it, but once you find it, you never forget where it is and you'll always come back. When you're driving out to Bodega Bay, there's a street called East Shore Road, and it's the one that takes you out to Bodega Head. Just go down East Shore Road and go straight the whole time. That road will dead end at the Sandpiper Restaurant.
There you go. 7 days a week, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Jay Schaefer, thank you so much for joining in on this.
Thank you.
Tumbleweedhouses.com.
Exactly.
I wish you just the best possible luck in the world. I think you're doing something at just the right time. And thank you for doing it. I think it's a really great contribution.
It has been such a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. I hope you have a wonderful morning on Tuesday. I will be having an inauguration breakfast luau. I think it is a day to celebrate no matter what your feelings were before the results of the election were in. It's a historic day. So enjoy yourself. Share the occasion and meet me back here next Sunday evening at 7 for another episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour here on KRCB.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes just the same as a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, and they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. There's a doctor and a lawyer and a business executive, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.